From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, after the explosion in West, other Texas towns want to know where the ammonia nitrate is stored.
We're still trying to balance security concerns with also the public right to know.
Libraries in Texas are facing a federal funding cutoff due to the lack of state support.
This will affect every single public library in Texas, large and small.
And a discussion with the author, Beverly D'Onofrio, about faith, surviving rape, and grace.
In the course of saying a Hail Mary out loud, he said, it's okay, I'm leaving, and he left.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. It was on April 17th that the town of West was leveled by an explosion at the local fertilizer plant. A fire broke out at the plant and the local volunteer fire department was sent in. There was that terrible explosion and 15 people were killed. More than 150 buildings were destroyed or severely damaged, including the local schools. Since that fateful day, little has changed in Texas to avoid another West-like explosion. In the last legislative session, no new laws or regulations were passed that require stricter guidelines or enforcement or regulation for storage of large amounts of ammonium nitrate fertilizer. The people of West and their local volunteer fire department didn't know that they were living in a blast zone. How could they have prepared and trained for the impending disaster if they were never told about the risk? Now, the Texas Fire Marshal's Office has launched a website that allows Texans to search for large amounts of the explosive ammonium nitrate fertilizer. Chris Connealy is the Fire Marshal of Texas.
After doing the research, we had four databases that we researched, two federal and the Department of Homeland Security, the ATF, Explosive Licensing Database, and then the Department of State Health Services that has their Tier 2 reports, the repository for that in the state, and then the Office of State Chemists. We collapsed those four databases. We removed the redundancy and ultimately came up with 153 facilities. We still have some concerns of, do all of them have ammonium nitrate and what context? And so we did these, what I refer to as voluntary inspections or evaluations, where, one, we want to go out and confirm they still had ammonium nitrate. And quite frankly, after doing those inspections, we ultimately come to 110. And so we got that done. And then the next project the Homeland Security and Public Safety Committee charged us with was creating this MAP application, which went out this week. And so a citizen can type in their zip code, and an icon will appear if there's an ammonium nitrate facility. These are facilities that have 10,000 pounds or more of ammonium nitrate. And if there is one there, there's a map comes up with a rough location where it's at. We don't name the facility. We're still trying to balance security concerns with also the public right to know. And so in consultation with the Homeland Security Committee, we came up with this approach. And you'll get an icon there, you'll see a map, and then there'll be a message that comes to contact the local fire department, and it'll provide the phone number or the email for that department. So the citizen can contact the local fire department and ascertain what is there, what is in that facility, what's all involved. And we think that, the locals have the best idea, and certainly the local fire department. So, and if there's not one in that zip code, and like I said, there's no facility in this zip code. So that's been completed, all ahead of schedule, and I'm very proud of my staff for working so hard on that in collaboration with our other state partners. And then the next phase is, once we've identified these 110 facilities, they're in 71 counties across the state. And so we are going to go out to each county where these facilities are, and we're going to, again, reaffirm the best practices for storage of ammonium nitrate and the best practices for firefighter response, and discuss that with, the appropriate folks in the meeting on each of those issues. While we don't have a statewide fire code, we do know the best practices. They're on our website. We shared those when we did these voluntary inspections. going around the state, identifying these facilities. And once again, reaffirm that, because we're encouraging, you know, voluntary compliance. We have no authority to mandate at this point. That's something the legislature is going to make determination of next legislative session. But in the interim, you know, because we all have a vested interest, certainly all of us, local, state, everyone, we don't want to see another West incident happen. And I always state that when you follow best practices, it's hard to get in trouble.
You mentioned there were security concerns. That's something that's definitely got to be part of this process. And the concern is we don't want any individual of ill will, a terrorist, to get hold of this material because obviously it's a very volatile substance.
That's correct. And that's why we're trying to balance that concern. Obviously, with the Oklahoma City bombing, you know, Mr. McVeigh had acquired ammonium nitrate, and hence why the federal regulations related to ammonium nitrate changed since that event. And so we're trying to, again, it's a balance of sharing with the community of things they need to be aware of and they want to know about, but also not.
But we don't want to keep these areas in the dark. If you're living in a neighborhood, if you've got a school in that neighborhood, you have a right to know as well.
Absolutely. And so that's why we took this approach. We've been very much in discussions with the Homeland Security Committee to try to make sure we're finding that balance. And so this map application, it doesn't tell you the name of the facility, how much they have. We already know it's at least 10,000 pounds. But that said, that's the approach we're using, and we think it's a good approach.
And it's interesting about you're going to go to the 71 counties where we have seen that there is a hit on this map. We're having this ammonium nitrate in over 10,000 pounds. And you're going to have these community meetings, try and get a dialogue going. Let's get the volunteer fire department in here. Let's get the school district in here. Let's talk about this, right?
Absolutely. Well, this is primarily a local jurisdiction issue. You know, they have this facility in their community, and certainly we just want to help facilitate conveying information of the best practices that are related to both storage of the product, what to do if an incident occurs, whether it be the first responders, the community, emergency management personnel, so that they have some resources and information. And more importantly, we ask as a state, what more do you need? You know, we'll have, you know, Texas A&M, the fire training school, their staff will be there. What additional training maybe the firefighters might need or emergency management personnel? And more so answer their questions and what additional resources they may need, and so that we're all working collectively to, you know, move forward and, again, make sure we don't have another event like this.
How exact do you think this database is? Are there supplies of ammonium nitrate in Texas that are more than 10,000 pounds that didn't make this database?
Your question is we think there's still other.
Yeah, I mean, you say it's voluntary compliance. Is that right?
Well, it's voluntary compliance in the sense of when we go out there and we seek to go on site, because, again, we don't have the authority as a fire code to mandate, you know, compliance with fire code regulations. We encourage them. We give them a report. This is what we found. We're making sure that they've reported to the Department of State Health Services, filled out a Tier 2 report. They've reported to the Department of Homeland Security. Again, reinforce best practices. So we do that. But as far as, you know, we feel pretty confident because we look at these four databases and we even contacted suppliers that sell ammonium nitrate in Texas. We feel pretty confident, while this list will always be somewhat dynamic, we feel pretty confident we've identified all the facilities in the country. And quite frankly, the Department of Homeland Security with a presidential executive order, you know, the federal government has some tight timelines to address improving you know, chemical safety and workplaces and what have you, that, you know, they look to Texas as we've made a lot of progress since our enforcement incident in the West, and they're looking to us as basically a beta site on how to roll this out throughout the rest of the United States.
Chris Connealy is the Fire Marshal of Texas. This week, he launched a website with an online program that allows Texans to enter a zip code and see if there's a nearby ammonia nitrate storage facility of more than 10,000 pounds or 5 tons. We have a link to that website on our website at tpr.org. Texas libraries are facing a new threat: the cutoff of millions of dollars in federal funds. The federal grant that supports the libraries around the state is being cut because the state government has slashed its supports for local libraries. Now, Texas doesn't qualify for that federal grant. Gloria Meraz is the Director of Communications for the Texas Library Association.
The state library, the Texas State Library and Archives Commission, has typically received about $10 to $11 million every year from federal funds from the Institute of Museum and Library Services. Because of the statewide cuts to library programs back in the 2011 legislative session, Texas no longer meets the maintenance of effort requirement for those federal dollars. So we are at a point now where the state library submitted its budget for 2012, and they submitted that at the end of last year, December 2012, and the agency has just been notified by IMLS, this is the Institute for Museum and Library Services, that it is no longer meeting that maintenance of effort requirement, and so it is no longer eligible for that funding.
I remember covering the story in 2011 when they were talking about state cutting its funds for a state library system. It allowed libraries to, on a regional basis, to do a lot of coordination and work together, maybe book buys or a sharing of resources. And that went away, right?
It did go away. And the sad fact is that Texas libraries were hit in two different directions. Because of the funding cuts in 2011, state money for a lot of library programs was eliminated. Because of that, other programs that had been secured through federal money are now in danger. When the state cuts first happened in 2011, some of the programs that were cut were what was called the Lone Star Libraries Program, which was a grant program for local communities, funding for what we call the Tech Share Program, which is electronic resources for libraries. And because of the domino effect of having to not have that state money, some federal money was shifted to try to secure at least some of these programs, namely the Electronic Resource Program. Because of that, the systems program that you were talking about that basically provided regional support for public libraries to help local libraries provide programming, help them provide training for the public, to teach local librarians how to improve collections and so on, that was entirely cut.
That made us more dependent on the federal dollars that we were getting.
Exactly. And now with notification that our waiver petition has been denied, if the federal government does not revisit that, then we will have far less money for library services in the coming years. We had been using that federal money, as I say, to take some of the burden for the funding for the Electronic Resources Program. But unfortunately, we have several other programs that are now funded with those federal dollars, including library grant programs, including sustaining that electronic resource sharing program. Every single bit of money that now the state library is using to support library development throughout Texas is actually that federal money now. So if we don't get that waiver, if that federal money doesn't come back to Texas, then I really can't tell you what the landscape for library services is going to look like in the next 2 years.
Now, this is not for the big city libraries like we have in Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin. This is mainly for the smaller town libraries.
This will affect every single public library in Texas, large and small. It will also affect academic libraries. These are university libraries and even some school libraries. The difference, of course, is that larger libraries have different sources of funding. Large public libraries, say in the Houston area or Dallas area, are predominantly funded by local dollars. But the state funding helps shore up the cost of some very expensive programs that all libraries use, like the electronic resources that I mentioned.
Right, but if you in these smaller town libraries, this is really the heart of a community. It's used for more than just books. This is where people come together and have community town hall meetings. I love to go to when I go to a small town, go check out the local library. They'll usually have like an old drugstore case with some artifacts from the founding of the town. And it's very interesting. And you get a feel for the town inside that library. Those are the ones that I worry about.
Well, I think the losses for the small libraries will be devastating. And again, this is coming already on the very steep state cuts from 2011. There are many libraries that were getting some of the cooperative grant money that was coming through the state library. And again, this is federally funded. And that money was used for programming, for different sorts of very fundamental services that communities provide. And there just isn't any replacement for that money. It's very striking to us that in so many small communities, and I will say that the majority of public libraries in Texas are in small communities. Right around 75% of the public libraries in Texas are in serving populations of 25,000 or below. The loss of the federal money is going to be huge. As you say, these small community libraries are the focal point. These are communities that don't have a Barnes & Noble. There's no place to shop for books. Some places are so far away from other kinds of services like technology, free computer access. So if that small library is no longer able to provide services, training, or even has to reduce its hours, it will affect the entire community.
Gloria Meraz is the Director of Communications of the Texas Library Association. She tells us Texas will be losing millions of dollars in federal support for local libraries across the state due to the cutoff in state dollars for the Texas public libraries. Author Beverly D'Onofrio was on a search for a more contemplative life. The path led her to San Miguel de Allende, where she lived and researched monasteries that she might join. In the midst of this, she was the victim of an attack, one that shook her faith and eventually led her on another road, one of prayer and peace that she couldn't have imagined. Yvette Benavides spoke with Beverly D'Onofrio about her latest memoir, Astonished, A Story of Evil, Blessings, Grace, and Solace.
Your previous memoirs chronicle your many lives, your time as a young mother mainly, but your most recent book, Astonished, is about your life most recently. You'd made a home in San Miguel de Allende, literally built a house, made a home, and you were chasing your faith, or at least a more contemplative spiritual life. But what happened then?
I had moved to San Miguel because I thought that the Virgin Mary was more obviously present there than the United States, that I could keep my faith alive, that God was alive in Mexico. And but then the faith sort of began to fade like fabric in the sun. I had this amazing conversion experience, and it just went flat on me. And when this happened, around that time, I went off to a monastery in Connecticut and lit on fire, decided that I must join a monastery, that this was the answer to infuse my life with a God spirit, to make the ordinary, sacred, to, you know, devote my life to the spirit, and came back to Mexico, began hotly looking for a monastery that might have a grant, who might accept a grandmother who would have to leave to go visit her grandson, because my grandson had been born 8 months before, and a rapist appeared in my bed, a serial rapist. I knew who he was. He'd been raping women in four other women in my town for the previous 8 months. And I thought, now that I've made this decision is when a rapist comes to my bed. And that launches the journey of this book. The first, I guess, chapter talks about that experience. And then I need to heal and need to understand how this God that I conceived of as a love that infuses everything would allow such a thing to happen, how there can be evil in a world that I think is supported by love. So I go off to monasteries, five of them to begin with, and then find one where, that I want to go and live in. And I stay there for 3.5 years, healing and searching and thinking and contemplating and really, in a way, having the time of my life. And I do come to some, I don't know, I can't say understanding, but I can say peace about what happened, and I heal and experience joy, and that's basically the trip of this book, the journey that I take in this book.
Flannery O'Connor said many times that in her stories, in her fiction, there has to be this moment of complete violence and trauma for a character before she or he can achieve some kind of moment of grace. And I always think about your book in those terms, and this particular terrible thing that happened to you in those terms, because of the way that you somehow managed even to pray for the rapist and to rally the people of that community in San Miguel, and then ultimately he's caught. And you're able to go on and try to embrace your faith as best you can. Did it ever feel that way to you? Like were there glimmers of grace along the way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, almost immediately after this horrific experience, time slowed down and everything was infused with significance and wonder. Everything was what I had been hoping would happen had I gone off to a monastery. It's what I was looking for in my life, to have meaning and an intensity. And it's called spiritual people call it a liminal space. It just, it's kind of like you see through the veil a little bit. And I never had such an experience before, and it launched me, it opened me up to all kinds of possibilities that I didn't know existed before, a way of seeing, a way of just kind of letting the masks I wore fall away, and they really did for a time. Of course, I've built them back up now, but it really was a period of grace for sure. And you know, thinking to pray when, see, I had heard that this rapist liked to talk afterwards and kill time until he repeated his attack. And in his talking, he to the other women, he would say how sick he is and how he can't stop himself and look for sympathy. And he began talking to me, and I thought, I'm not going to talk to him. I'm just going to pray and remove myself from the situation, and began praying silently. And then it occurred to me to pray out loud and maybe freak him out. And as I'm praying out loud, he says, stop praying. And then I said, I'm praying for you lying. And I thought, I should pray for him. And it was just, and I prayed for him, and then I thought, well, I should pray for myself. I haven't even done that yet. And asked God to help me and to get him out of my house. And in the course of saying a Hail Mary out loud, he said, it's okay, I'm leaving, and he left. And then I wrote about it in the town paper, and they printed the Hail Mary in Spanish and English. People cut it out. People memorized it. People had it by their beds. Women carried it in their bags. The whole town started praying, and people would come up to me and say, it feels different now, because we were all freaked out because he could break in to anywhere. Everybody felt endangered, and people were selling their houses, people were putting bars on their windows, and suddenly people were saying, the energy feels different now, he's going to get caught. And 5 days after the article appeared, 5 days after the town started praying, he was caught. And it was an amazing affirmation of what prayer can do. And that was a wonderful thing for me to witness, that, you know, in a tangible sort of way, what the faith of people, what a collective longing or desire can bring about.
Well, that's incredible. Well, last month you published a piece in the New York Times, Confessions of a Serial Memoirist.
Mm-hmm.
And you confess there, among other things, that you are compulsive, self-absorbed, and various other pretty self-effacing descriptors.
Narcissistic,
bossy. Yes. Most of us couldn't admit those things about ourselves. You were very brave. You know, the unexamined life isn't worth living, right?
Right.
But I was thinking about that piece where you're so honest and, you know, some of it is tongue-in-cheek and some of it is very light in tone about, you know, what a memoirist does. But thinking about this book and the things that happened to you, the things about this horrific attack and fear, because you said someplace that you suffered from a type of PTSD where falling asleep was the trigger because that's when the rapist came to into your home. And I thought, how do you look at a situation like this that you're writing about, this most horrific thing, through that lens of, you know, this idea that we're self-absorbed and we're narcissistic and we're always navel-gazing? It's different. Do you feel like, as a memoirist, because of this experience, these experiences and this book, that your writing is different now forever?
Oh, I think so. I never put it into those words, but yeah, I think so. And I can't even articulate how, except I'm not so afraid to go deeper, to go slowly, to kind of search for the metaphor, to go down roads I don't know where they're leading. This book wasn't so much about writing Cars with Boys, my first one. I had a mission. I wanted to tell young people that don't give up your dreams. If you screw up early in life, it doesn't mean it's the end of the world, even though it feels like it. Get yourself to college and you'll get back on your feet. Don't give up. So I had that mission, but I also really wanted to entertain. I really thought of it as a movie as I was writing it as a book, and then it did become a movie. And with this one, how could I explain it? I definitely had an awareness of speaking to my future audience, of writing this story to tell it to other people. But I was also really asking questions of myself and coming to great understanding through the writing, understandings that I never could have come to just by thinking. And it was just really the most, I mean, writing is always hard and sometimes excruciating, but that said, it was the most joyful writing experience I've ever had, and satisfying.
Beverly D'Onofrio is the author of the memoirs Riding in Cars with Boys, Looking for Mary, and Astonished, A Story of Evil Blessings, Grace, and Solace. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You're also invited to comment directly on our website at tpr.org. That's also where you can find past Texas Matters programs posted. And you can find us on iTunes. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.